Facebook.com.
Hello, what's up, everybody? Thank you for joining me here on this Monday, January 2nd edition of Bang the Book Radio. My name is Adam Burke, your host for the next 90 minutes or so. We'll go over all kinds of things in the world of sports from a betting focus. Happy to have you with me here as we kick off the 2017 calendar year on Bang the Book Radio. We'll be joined today by Joe Everett for our NFL Week in Review and Monday Night Football Preview segment. Of course, there is no Monday Night Football, so I guess we need to change the name of this bit here, but we will preview Wild Card Weekend. With the four games that are coming up, we've got lines out for those already. So we'll get some thoughts on that from Joe Everett of NFL Draft Bible. And then also we'll have a full hour with Kyle Hunter of HunterSportsPicks.com. For our college football first look today, we'll take a look at the Sugar Bowl, which is the late kickoff tonight between Auburn and Oklahoma. We'll also look at the college football national championship game between Clemson and Alabama. Then we'll look at some college basketball stuff, give you some thoughts on home court advantage and also some of the big matchups coming up here this week on the hardwood. But with that, we'll go ahead and bring in today's first guest, our first guest of 2017. That is Mr. Joe Everett of NFL Draft Bible. Joseph, how are you today, sir?
Great. Kicking off the new year right, I'd say. Got the college football bowl games about to wrap up, and it's been 17 crazy weeks, but it's just good to have it in the books.
Yeah, it definitely is. And I know you get extremely busy here in the month of January. I know you can't make it next week, but we certainly appreciate your time as you've got that College Gridiron Showcase going on. Of course, the Senior Bowl, setting up the big board for the NFL Draft, all kinds of stuff going on in Joe Everett's world. So make sure you check out all of his great work over at NFL Draft Bible. But Joe, let's recap week 17 here before we look ahead to what's going on during the wild card weekend, because, you know, It was a tough week for handicapping purposes. You had a lot of varying levels of motivation out there. You had some games that wound up being closer than they should have been, had some backdoor covers with the underdogs. Not really a big surprise here with some of these teams sort of punting in the final weekend. But what really stood out to you from week 17?
Well, a couple of situations that I'm happy I took part in was just that Chiefs game. And the Raiders, really, like we talked about last week, without Carr, and even now with the McGloin situation, there's a lot of trouble there. And as a Broncos supporter, I was really glad they kind of closed out the season. But, yeah, the Chiefs really shutting down that game. They made a couple of mistakes, but grasping up on that two seed, I think that was a real power move for them. Sure, they got fortunate that the Broncos got the job done, but I think they stand out. And then Tommy Brady, touchdown Tommy. I mean, to me, everyone's talking about who's the MVP, and you know, he throws Zeke and Dak out there. But I really, if it's not Brady, then what's the award for? Well, what he's come back from, the pressure he responded to, the absence of those four games, and I think more than anything, the absence of Gronkowski. There's been no drop-off in his production. I think he's just at that next level of not just diagnosing and reading defenses. That's become second nature to him, but I think he's really playing with his receivers, doing audibles, doing total checkdowns with Edelman and guys like that. And then, boy, adding Floyd from Arizona to this little mix, Cardinals fans have to hate that, just seeing him play so well for him last week. I think, yeah, the Chiefs and the Patriots really stand out as, I think, strong playoff teams. And if that's not the AFC championship game, I'd kind of be surprised. Sorry, Steeler fans, but I think the Chiefs have got a good look, and then I think the Patriots just have the best player in the game right now, and it's not even close to my eyes.
Tom Brady here, 11-1 since he came back, 28-2 touchdown interception ratio. And I mean, that was a game that truthfully the Patriots didn't really have a whole lot of stock in. I mean, certainly they could wrap up home field advantage throughout the AFC playoffs, and they already had the bye. But for them to go out there and systematically dismantle Miami the way that they did out on the road, I know Miami had nothing to play for either. But you kind of feed off a guy like Tom Brady in that situation, and obviously, New England was certainly able to do that. But I want to throw a little wrench in your MVP plan here. Aaron Rodgers, I mean, this is a guy that came out and said, hey, our team can run the table, and obviously he orchestrated that. 40 touchdown passes here this season. And you give Mike McCarthy credit, and we've talked about this on previous segments with his usage of Ty Montgomery and sort of changing things up a little bit on the offense. But, man, Aaron Rodgers made some throws last night that no human being should be able to make.
He looked great. And the level of ascension, it's just from where he started this season and the confidence making that claim. You know, I guess I'd have to back off and say if they gave him the award, I would have less arguments as with other candidates. And it has been impressive just taking them through that run and developing Devontae Adams, also doing this without Cobb, doing it without a running game. I think, yeah, he does get a lot of credit for that. But I also think that on the other side, man, Tommy, I think that he's playing better than his record-setting year when Moss and Welker were out there doing it. And just with his supporting cast, I don't know, I guess I'm a little bit more impressed, but there's some truth saying that Aaron Rodgers has played through some really difficult circumstances, the injuries on defense, the injuries on the O-line. And, yeah, as we mentioned, who's the running back? Well, a converted wide receiver who's playing well, but I think a lot of it is, as you mentioned, it's on Rodgers to take it upon himself. He really took it up the next level and playing hurt. There's, he's got a strong MVP case to be made. I'd give you that.
I don't know, maybe Olivia Munn is the MVP. You know, everyone was kind of piling on her with Aaron Rodgers' struggles. I think maybe she might deserve some credit here in all of this. We'll continue with the very lukewarm takes, because I think going with Tom Brady and Aaron Rodgers for MVP is not exactly earth-shattering. And I like this one that you mentioned here. You want to kill the Pro Bowl, which, I mean, I'm not going to lie. I have no disagreement with that.
Yeah, and I know that's maybe weak sauce by some, but I just, if I've got a sounding box and an idea I'd like to put out there, it just make it into an all-star team or an AP All-American vote like college football has. That way that people get their acknowledgement. You save the players from the injury. You spare them from a game they don't want to play and a garbage game fans don't want to watch. But I think what's more importantly here that I started thinking about the other day, like, these players watching week 17, it's about accelerators. It's about incentives. It's about bonus checks to get a markage and yardage. And there's the also making the Pro Bowl. It's written in people's contracts, yet there's a third of that vote that is on fans. And then a third of that vote is on players. And only a third is the coaches. Well, fans are just as biased as anybody. I could see someone just living outside of Three Rivers putting every Steelers he can into the vote no matter what. And then some of those players, they're biased for their buddies that they're tight with. Like, man, I'd like to see Alshon in a Pro Bowl. Well, Alshon Jeffrey didn't have a Pro Bowl season. It just seems sometimes, why let biased players decide who gets a bonus check and who doesn't? That, to me, that's like letting the inmates run the prison. So I think the Pro Bowl's just got to go. I think a lot of people would agree with it, but it still has a place. Acknowledgement has to be made, you know, and I think they should just have this all-star first team, all-star second team, as voted by coaches that can't vote for their own players and can only vote for opposing teams. I think that'd be the fairest way to do it, and that way these guys are also being compensated financially based on, the evaluator, I guess is what I'm saying.
Well, and I was just sort of going in order of the notes that you sent me here. So we'll get back into week 17, and it was Black Sunday. It's not even Black Monday. We have six coaches already out on the street. We'll see if we have more of them coming. But one of the teams that you mentioned here that you want to talk about coming out of week 17, a team that you certainly know, a team that's kind of near and dear to your heart, I guess, that's the Indianapolis Colts. What is it that you want to touch on with this team?
I just think they need to move on, and if they don't, it's just going to be more of the same. There's no offensive cohesion. What I'm hearing out of here is that Gregson more than likely is out, but there's Pagano is still on a lifeline somehow. So I just think that we had that window with Andrew Luck for being underpaid for a good 4 years, and the Colts had a cap-friendly situation to develop a surrounding cast, and I just think they have anything but right now. There's nothing solid outside of T.Y. Hilton, Vontae Davis, and furthermore, the Colts, I think they have to have a wholesale move and changeover, even in the training staff, in my opinion. Just the injuries, they seem to recur. Every single year, Vontae Davis is hurt. Luck's style may lead to him getting banged up, but T.Y. Hilton, always issues. Dante Moncrief missed the majority of the season. Arthur Jones is hurt every single season. So maybe that's just his issue. But, yeah, I think the building's got to change. The medical staff's got to change. The coaching staff's got to change. And Grigson, yeah, he's as good as gone. But, yeah, I'm looking for a new regime, and I would really vote that maybe they go offensive-minded, because there's some very intriguing guys outside of the big names that we've always talked about, you know, like Shanahan's out there, sure, McDaniels, but what about a Mark Trestman out there? What about a Kenny Wisenhunt? McCoy, that whole staff is gone. Marty Morningwig, also from the Baltimore staff, should be available. Greg Roman's available. I would love to see maybe a Kenny Wisenhunt-Morningwig combo. That wouldn't be the worst thing in the world. I just think the Colts offense right now is really what's holding them back. And sure, there's a loft issue in the defense that's lack of bleeping talent. But I think the major problem is you've got a franchise marquee player that is not playing nearly up to his level. And that needs to be addressed first and foremost.
Well, let's talk about the Cleveland Browns, which is something that a lot of people aren't really saying here on the day after the regular season, but they tried very valiantly to take themselves out of the first overall pick, which, you know, I was actually out at a New Year's Day family dinner, and we were making some jokes about the game, and it was entertaining to watch, to say the least, because if there's anything that this team needed to win this year, it was the first overall pick, and they actually managed to do that. But they're on the clock. I mean, is Myles Garrett the guy here for this team? And if so, is that the right pick for this team?
I think it is the right pick. I mean, you really do have to go BPA, best player available, no question about it. And I look at Garrett as a game changer. It's either him or maybe even Jonathan Allen. I mean, that guy changes games. Right now, two or three defensive scores just on him. A defensive, like 300-pounder that can intercept passes, he just has to be double-teamed. That would be an asset. On the Browns defense, that's the area I'd look in. But, you know, I'm just, more than anything for Cleveland fans, I'd encourage them to remember that, you know, there's a boatload of picks outside of that top first rounder. You still got Philly's first rounder, Tennessee's second rounder. I don't know about the compensatory picks. They made that trade for Jamie Collins, which will cost them one, I believe, a high third rounder. But they still have Philly's 2018 second rounder. There's just a lot that Sashi Brown, the DePodesta crew, they're really going for quantity. And they're going to get some quality with that. I thought they drafted pretty well last year. So it's really, what quarterback do they bring in? And I just, more than anything, I hope they don't go for a DeShone Kizer. I really don't like this quarterback class. And being a Notre Dame fan, Adam, I've seen a lot of Kizer's games that I would encourage people to watch that Duke game and count how many throws he missed that were wide open. That was a win. It should have happened, and it just didn't, because it was, I hate to put it on one player, but Kizer missed a ton of throws. So anyone that thinks he's some top-level quarterback prospect, there's a couple of games just from this season alone that I would definitely have to, you know, earmark.
Well, we'll be able to talk about this a little bit more as we go through the winter and then, of course, into the spring. But as things stand right now, is Mitch Trubisky the top quarterback on your board?
No. I would honestly wait. I hate to say it, you know, I'd let someone else have at it, but forced to take the issue. I don't know that I'd put a quarterback in the first round based on evaluation, what I'd seen. I would, honest to goodness, I would wait till the second, maybe third round. And this is why I'd be a terrible GM, though. I would draft an injured Chad Kelly, who I know he's got problems mentally. He started a fight at his brother's high school game, I think was the big stake this year. And I just think he's gone through a lot to play major football and to be a starter, and he has an NFL arm. If you got that kid in with the right quarterbacks coach, maybe a Jay Gruden in Washington, good things could happen, because I really think that kid, he rips it.
Well, let's talk about Washington here, because the Redskins, their season ends in very disappointing fashion, and I really wish the end of that game would have had some implications on the spread, because that was very, very entertaining, to say the least, with the lateral going back that was scooped by the Giants and run back for a touchdown, and then they had to come out and line up for some kind of point after play and just took a knee. Really strange ending to that game, but the thing that stands out about that ending is Kirk Cousins with the backbreaking pick that keeps Washington out of the playoffs. Now, Of course, if the Redskins had been able to kick a field goal here or there throughout the season, they probably wouldn't have been in this position. But you've got Kirk Cousins here, impending free agent. You know, he probably doesn't want that to be his last throw in Washington, but I guess we have to see what happens with his contract status and if the Redskins are willing to pay up.
That's the crux of it, but I have to believe they have to. In the simple math of it, there's about 18 to 20 quarterbacks that are worth getting paid, and right now Cousins factors into that top group. But say what you want, he's made some critical errors, but he runs this system like no other. That Jay Gruden can depend on that. He can get this offense into good plays. And sure, he's not the world's greatest arm talent. There's no velocity on some of these passes. And boy, in some of the inclement weather they tend to play, and that could be down the road. But the consistency he's brought, what you can depend on, what you know and you can count on, there's just no other quarterback that's going to bring that. I don't care if they get someone in free agency, make a trade, or get a rookie. He is more valuable to them than any other franchise, and I think a lot of people would agree with that. And it's, it is a shame they didn't get to make the postseason, but this is another team, like, I'm looking at them, I think I've said it on a previous episode, there's going to be some good safeties out there in this class, and that is obviously the Achilles. They just can't stop anybody. I can't blame Josh Norman. It's just there's four DBs out there at all times, and he's just one of them. And, boy, that's where the other teams are throwing. Those safeties are killing them. But Malik Hooker out of Ohio State, should he declare? I'm infatuated with him, but you also have Jamal Adams out of LSU, Buda Baker, and yes, everyone loves Jabril Peppers. I think he's a little bit overrated, but bottom line, good class. They could help themselves a lot. It's just a shame because that offense was uncanny how efficient they were, and once again, I can't speak highly enough of Jay Gruden and what he's able to do with quarterbacks. I think, yeah, that's a team. They should draft a quarterback every year and let Jay Gruden work with them, and then in 3 years, sell him off. Just what Belichick's doing. It's like stocks. You know, like, well, we've got this Belichick-produced quarterback. Well, I'll give you a second-rounder. I think Washington, they could turn around and do the same.
That play that Malik Hooker made in the semifinal against Clemson, I mean, it was probably Ohio State's only highlight in that game. But there were a lot of pantsless scouts and evaluators after seeing that play. And that was just phenomenal closing speed, great awareness, and a hell of a catch, too, for somebody that plays defensive back. I mean, that's a ball a wide receiver usually only catches.
That was a little bit of validation, too. I'm sitting around with a lot of college football dorks, and I'm telling them about Malik Hooker is the next Bob Sanders, but without the injuries. He blows plays up. He's everywhere all at once. And there, you know, it's turning into the boat race, and everyone, well, where's your Malik Hooker now? And he made that play, and I was like, I want to tell you, this kid's something.
All right, let's move ahead to Wild Card Weekend here and sort of go over these four games that we have on tap. And, of course, things may start with a little bit of a whimper here between the Oakland Raiders and the Houston Texans at NRG Stadium in Houston, which will be the site of Super Bowl 51. But no Derek Carr. We'll see what Matt McGloin's status winds up being for this game. We may see Connor Cook in this one. And then Tom Savage got concussed last week for Houston. So maybe they have to go back to Brock Osweiler. So this basically just becomes a game about the defenses, right?
Yeah, and that the Texans have the better one. It's unfortunate we don't get to see kind of a rematch of that earlier game. I think it was the New Mexico City that the Raiders won. But I think the Texans, they have better corners. They've got a better front seven, attacking what could be a third-string rookie quarterback in Connor Cook, and he'll be eaten alive. But even if McGloin suits up, I think it's going to be tough sledding. Romeo Crennel's going to stack five, and that Oakland offense, they're going to depend on the run. But on the other side, Houston's in a really good position, even if Savage misses. This is the exact situation Brock wants to redeem himself and still a little bit of confidence going forward. And against a really terrible Oakland secondary, I think Will Fuller could have a big game here with the serious issues they have. Like, just speaking of loft, boy, the Raiders cornerbacks just can't run. And they've got Reggie Nelson, who's a quality tackler. He's another guy. Coach on the field gets him lined up. But the whole four, they can be exposed. And Will Fuller, if he gets a free release, that's going to be exactly what I think the Texans are going to go to early and often.
So if you're Bill O'Brien here, I mean, what is your game plan? Because you know you have that secondary that you can take some shots at, but also you've got Lamar Miller, who should be in better physical condition here, you know, with a little bit of a light workload over the last couple of weeks. So do you try and force the issue with the run? Do you look to exploit that defense early? I mean, do you sort of just, you know, expect to win a close, low-scoring, ugly game? How do you feel Bill O'Brien should play this one?
Well, and especially if Brock starts, I think you look to exploit his game. You get those play actions, get him out on bootlegs, and get him moving away from Khalil Mack, away from the Bruce Irvin pressures there, and run a lot of those screens. I don't even know if they've got to, like, really pound the run. Sure, they don't want a long game and let the Raiders in it. I'd assume they want to shorten the clock a little bit, but, yeah, they have to take advantage of the space and what Osweiler can do. He's very athletic for the height he's at and that kind of range and gait he's got. It's just a tough cover for a linebacker. So, yeah, I'd hope they do a lot more bootleg, movable pockets, and then take their shots where they can get them. And, you know, if the Raiders don't double up Nuk Hopkins, that's another issue. These tight ends they've got that are coming along, Fedorowicz and Griffin, I think they could exploit those Raiders linebackers. So this is epic. Yeah, the Raiders are in a little bit of trouble.
I think the next game is a good example, but I'll ask you as a last point here on this game. Houston was in the playoffs last year. They were in the wild card game. You know, it really didn't go well for them at all. They were beaten 30-0, and it was really never even close. I mean, the Chiefs came back the opening kick, and that was kind of the end of it. But at least Houston's been there. They do have a playoff game, and some of the longer holdovers from this roster were on the teams in 2011 and 2012 that made the playoffs. For Oakland, this is a team that hasn't made the playoffs since 2002. So we have a much bigger playoff experience edge in the next game between Detroit and Seattle. But do you feel like playoff experience, I mean, is that a thing? Is that, you know, something that can actually really be an advantage to a team? Or is it, you know, strictly about the X's and O's and the talent on the field and probably the coaching experience more so than anything?
Well, don't want to underrate the coaching experience. You know, Del Rio's been there, done it before. But, yeah, I stick with a good locker room, a veteran locker room, and a strong defense that has seen the postseason before. So and they've got a lot to prove themselves. They know they're a good defense. Sure, their best players on IR, but that should even give them more incentive to go out there and get that win. And, yeah, I would side with the better locker room, the better defense. Maybe not the stronger running game in this matchup, but, yeah, like you mentioned, that experience is only going to serve them well.
Would you play the three here, or do you just sort of feel like, you know, this is one of those situations where if you want to get involved in this game, maybe just look to play the Houston money line, pay that 155 or 160 type of price? Or do you think they actually can go out there and cover this number?
I think they've got a shot at covering the number, but once again, the quarterback play, you don't know what's going to happen. Two teams that haven't exactly been reliable, I would likely just do a teaser, get the Texans down and play that under and hike the total up to attempt to play this game safe, because it is a pretty ugly game.
All right, let's move to this NFC wildcard matchup then on Saturday night between the Detroit Lions and the Seattle Seahawks. Of course, we know the Seahawks, an extensive playoff resume. This is not the first rodeo for pretty much everybody on this roster. For Detroit, you know, there are a lot of guys that don't have a whole lot of playoff experience here. Now, the Lions have dropped three straight heading into the postseason. They really haven't looked very good in the process. But then again, you have a Seattle team. Hasn't won consecutive games since they beat the Patriots and the Eagles, so it's been a little while. They've alternated wins and losses over their last six. They haven't looked all that great. But I think the overriding sentiment here in this game, I think we kind of see it in terms of the early line movement with Seattle going from 7 to 7.5 to 8. There's actually 8.5 out there as well. Is I think there's this notion from public players out there and probably even some sharp players as well that this Seattle team can just flip the switch when it wants to.
Exactly, and that I would question a little bit. There's a couple of players that we've talked about on previous shows missing that makes this a different Seattle team. And, you know, it's sure, you can rely on winning tradition all you want, but I forget who did this quote, but winning tradition, well, that's like a season ticket. You still have to renew that thing every year, and I don't know if they've paid their dues, because without Earl Thomas in that back half, it's a bit of a different story. Still, though, this Detroit offense, and as you mentioned, their slide, as good as Zach Zenner looked last night, they're going to struggle to move the ball on the ground. This Seattle front four, still no joke. I think they'll have to rely on Golden Tate kind of to get the job done. And Matt Stafford, I think that finger injury has showed up in the record books, I'll admit, and I was questioning it myself, but I'd still argue this guy, sure, he's lost some subtleties, some nuances of throws, the checkdowns, taking steam off a ball has changed his throwing arc, but he still zips that thing into warp drive like nobody else. And, you know, what an arm talent. If you've got a piece of plastic locking your middle finger into a straight position and still able to spin the thing like he does, I mean, boy, he's really making his money this year without Megatron, all banged up, still toughing it out. I can't speak highly enough of Stafford, but, yeah, I don't know that I'd agree with everyone saying, well, the Seahawks are just going to flip that switch and get it done. But they've got some matchup advantages with Jimmy Graham really playing well. I think he's a guy that started slow this season because of that was a torn patella tendon I think he had. But as the season progressed, he's finally kind of picking up steam. Doug Baldwin can still move the chains for the Hobbit here. So, yeah, and then the 12th man, it is a huge advantage playing out there that teams tend to struggle. And I guess if Detroit wants a chance in this, they're going to have to rely on that front four of theirs that's been answering the bell every week. Ziggy Ansah, Kerry Hyder, and where they got him, Haladi Nada, Ba'Shawn Robinson, and even guys behind them like Devin Taylor, that's a really good rotation. So they're going to really have to apply the pressure early and often if they want to stay in this one.
I don't know if people realize how good of a football player Doug Baldwin is. I mean, he's a top five, top 10 route runner in the NFL, and man, he is just vastly overlooked.
Oh, you could set your watch to that kid. And I think what it is the offense he comes out of at Stanford. He was already running pro routes for Harbaugh and Dave Shaw, but he gets there and you know, they just find out it's like, well, we didn't have to coach him as hard as the other guys, and he is another player that just he has picked it up every single consecutive year. So, yeah, you want to talk about the all-underrated team. He is definitely deserving of a spot on that roster.
Well, let's move to the other AFC wildcard game here. This one's the early kick on Sunday between Miami and Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh laying double digits here in this one. And, you know, I've talked about this on previous shows, and Pittsburgh was actually my Super Bowl pick prior to the season. So we'll see if I can wind up picking something right in the NFL here this year. But, you know, I mean, they're laying 10 points. And there are not a whole lot of people believing in Miami here in this spot. I know you've talked up Adam Gase quite a bit here throughout the season. Maybe this line is 9 or 8.5 if Tannehill's out there. But I mean, does Miami really get blown out in this game? Is Pittsburgh that much better of a team than them right now?
At this point, I hate to say it. I don't know that I'm going to be jumping on all that massive amount of points and laying it. But, yeah, I don't see how Miami can win this. And the Steelers, I don't know that it's a huge factor. They got a little bit of revenge on their mind. Was it week 6, week 7? I forget when the Dolphins knocked Big Ben out of that last game. So that might be on the forefront. But Matt Moore in this Three Rivers, that's going to be an issue. Sure, this is a beatable secondary, but I don't see the torque needed to put the ball in some of these routes to attack the seams, attack the safeties, and take advantage of that perimeter speed that Miami has. This is another team they're going to have to try and shorten this game, put Jay Ajayi and that offensive line out, and just really win that battle and rough the Steelers up front. So that's pretty much their only hope. But the problem is the killer bees. Bell, Brown, Big Ben, the Dolphins secondary, they are overrated, overpaid with Byron Maxwell. They're missing their best player in Rashad Jones. And then I love reminding people, by the way, Tony Lippett was a wide receiver at Michigan State that they just converted. They're now got, I think, Xavien Howard, the rookie out of Baylor, is probably their best secondary defender right now. And Michael Thomas and Walt Akins, their safeties, are just backups. They lost Jones. I think they also, Issa Abdul-Kudus, they're both out on injured reserve. So I just can't imagine the Dolphins having a chance where you've got Antonio Brown and all these the Big Ben against basically a secondary full of backups.
Well, and keep in mind too here, and I mean, this is something that, you know, we talk about a lot with Miami. When they get late into the season, they're going to have to go out and play a cold weather game. It looks like right now, no precipitation in the forecast, but highs in the mid 20s in Pittsburgh on Sunday. So, you know, obviously that's a concern that you have to worry about as well. And we'll see if we get some totals action later in the week here based on that. One more game to get to, the other NFC wildcard matchup. The New York Giants take on the Green Bay Packers. Just talked up Aaron Rodgers quite a bit. But this Giants defense is clearly getting a significant amount of respect here in this game. Packers only favored by 4 at home at Lambeau Field. And I think that's a pretty telling indicator. I like to say that the line tells a story. I think this one pretty much does with the way that the Packers come rolling into the playoffs.
Momentum is a real big factor, probably in that number, but this is another game, I think a rematch, and the Giants got the worst end of it in a real close game. And more than anything that I've taken away from the Giants watching them this year is this defense has teeth. Steve Spagnuolo, a phenomenal job he's done. And those unders, boy, howdy, what is it, like 12-4, 13-3? I forget the exact number, but they're limiting teams. And the biggest factor, just watching Green Bay in that game, and it hurts me because I love Quentin Rollins. Interviewed him live, MAC Defensive Player of the Year, a former point guard for Miami, Ohio, and what the player he's turned himself into. You really start to pull for these guys when you get to know them, and man, seeing him suffer that injury on just a freak sort of flip in his neck and the head, I'd be surprised if he plays this week. If the Packers don't get Demarius Randle back from injury, then you want to talk about a team running with their fourth, fifth string corner starting on the perimeters against Odell Beckham, Sterling Shepard, and Victor. That is not exactly a recipe for success. So the injury report for the Packers in the secondary, I think, is paramount in this game.
You know, and I've watched a couple of Giants games here recently. When I was out in Vegas, I watched the Cowboys game on Sunday night with a buddy of mine. And I was, I'm not going to say disgusted with Eli Manning, because obviously the conditions weren't fantastic for throwing the football in that game, but there was no life on anything that he threw. And then I'm watching as they beat the Redskins, and that dime that he threw to Tavares King, almost like it came out of nowhere. I'm just sitting there going, man, this guy's still got it in there somewhere. And you mentioned those Green Bay secondary injuries. That's a big worry here. I mean, I don't know about the side, but I have to think at this point, you know, we get a pretty low total here with this Giants defense sitting at 44. Seems like there's a chance both teams can have a little bit of offensive success.
That's definitely a fact. And once again, that this is one I wouldn't play until I find out for certain the health of Demarius Randle, the health of Quentin Rollins. And it maybe that would be an intriguing way to play it as another. I love these teasers to maybe tease that total up a little bit. And there would be no sweat involved to the evening. But yeah, as hot as Aaron Rodgers has been, and right now they've pretty much got a healthy core. We'll see if Randall Cobb can get back in the lineup. But even without him, I thought Geronimo Allison, another kid, you know, JUCO out of Illinois, just really didn't have a lot of exposure. Late invite to the Senior Bowl, and, you know, the Packers take a chance. They're always willing to go with a guy that has size and length. No matter how speed deficient Allison is, he really has proved to be a threat. He's got consistent ball skills, and, yeah, that kid's long. And, you know, get rid of Jeff Janis, because I think Allison could develop into a little something for him. Just that extra dime receiver, the fourth guy that can make a difference. And yeah, I think you hit it on the head. That's why that number is this momentum that the Packers have taken in, that win streak, that Lambeau home field advantage. Green Bay's got a lot going for him, that's for certain.
Well, and it won't be the Ice Bowl or the Snow Bowl or anything like that at Lambeau Field, but it's going to be cold this week. 13 on Wednesday, 6 on Thursday, 10 on Friday, 12 on Saturday. So it'll be nice and cold on Sunday for this game. Cold, hard field, cold, hard football. Weather could be a factor in 3 of these 4 playoff games this weekend. So it's definitely important for all of our listeners to keep that in mind as we head into the wild card weekend. But Joe Everett of NFL Draft Bible. Joe, what's going on over there at the Bible right now?
Can't stop, won't stop. This is the beginning of the All-Star circuit. I'm going to be doing a trifecta this year, from the College Gridiron Showcase to down in St. Petersburg, Florida for the East-West Shrine Game for a week, and then down to Mobile, Alabama for the Senior Bowl, the unofficial official NFL convention. So basically from this Wednesday till the 4th to the 30th, I will not be coming back home.
You can follow Joe on Twitter at Joe W. Everett and also at NFL Draft Bible on Twitter. Joe, appreciate your time as always, man. Thank you so much. We'll talk to you again here in a couple of weeks.
All right. Sounds good, Adam. Thanks.
Good stuff there with Joe Everett. Good introductory look at the wild card weekend. And we'll certainly talk more with our professional handicappers here as we go throughout the week, looking ahead to the NFL playoffs. But we'll flip over to the college side of things here. Bring in Kyle Hunter of huntersportspicks.com. Kyle, how's it going today, buddy?
Going good, man. Looking forward to the coming week. We've got a lot going on here. I'm looking forward to talking some college football and some college basketball.
Yeah, and we'll be transitioning over here to mostly college basketball. I think we'll touch a little bit on the national championship game on next week's segment. But for the most part here going forward, it'll be college basketball as we start looking ahead to March. And we got a lot of conference play before we get to that point. Today we're going to talk Sugar Bowl, also look at the opening line for the national championship game. But before we do that, anything that you want to throw out that you saw in the semifinal games or anything else that's gone on in the college football world?
Well, I mean, neither of those games were very competitive, obviously. You know, Ohio State just laid an egg in that game. And everybody knows that, you know, both you and I are Ohio State fans. And I'm willing to say that, you know, Clemson just totally dominated them in every way. I think Clemson was better in every aspect of the game. They were better, well-prepared. Ohio State got out-coached. Obviously, Urban Meyer's still a great coach, but, you know, not his best showing there in that game. This Ohio State team was not near as good as some of the other Ohio State teams. I think both of us knew that going into the game. You know, I didn't know it was going to be that type of a game, that's for sure. But, you know, that Clemson defense being that good really was the big surprise. Ohio State's offense not great, but Clemson's defense just dominating in that game. And I think more than anything, takeaway for me was Brent Venables is just tremendous. Really, really good defensive coordinator. The offense did well also, obviously. I don't think the Buckeyes defense was that bad. I think it was mainly just the offense was so bad. The defense was on the field a lot. And then in the other game, you know, Washington got off to that good start. Just couldn't do anything on offense after that. Bama's defense really, really looked good. So Bama and Clemson both just so good on defense. Saturday was the big takeaway for me.
Yeah, these are the two teams that deserve to be there in the college football playoff. And you and I, it can be frustrating when you do let your fandom get in the way of making a little bit of money, because I know you and I, you know, it's very tough to go against Ohio State in any capacity. But as we talked about on the show last week, and you know, as we talked about with our other handicappers as well, it was clear that Clemson was going to be the preferred side in that game. And then as we got closer to kickoff, it was sharp money. It was public money. It was all of it coming in on Clemson. And in some books, Clemson even closed a favorite. And, you know, that was sort of a – that was a really important game for a lot of the sharp players out there, because I was surprised to see the level of Washington money that came in, but I wasn't necessarily surprised to see the outcome.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, we knew that that line, that Clemson line, was going to go down. And if I wasn't a Buckeyes fan, I would have played Clemson in that game. And, yeah, it's always a bummer to you know, miss out on that opportunity. You know, sometimes you just have to suck it up and look at afterwards, be like, man, you know, missed opportunity. But having said that, you know, my line wasn't too far off from the line. I just felt like it was a bad matchup for Ohio State, and it certainly was. I think Ohio State's going to have a lot better teams in the coming years. I think that game on Saturday did some damage to their perception for those years, that's for sure. And Clemson, you know, they have the quarterback, Deshaun Watson, probably the best player in the country. You know, and I'm not trying to take anything away from Lamar Jackson, but I think Deshaun Watson, the best player in the country, that helps a lot. You know, like you said on last week's show too, Dabo Swinney really deserves a lot of credit at this point. You know, he's really came up big for them in a lot of big games. So, you know, he shouldn't be really taking a backseat to anybody at this point.
No, another win over Urban Meyer, and I like what you said about Brent Venables, who at this point, to me, for my money, is the best defensive coordinator in the country. And
yeah,
At some point, he'll probably leave for a head coaching job, but I believe he's the highest paid defensive coordinator in the country, too. So, yeah, I mean, he's certainly worth the money that he's making there. I'll look at a couple of games that haven't happened yet. We'll start with the Sugar Bowl between Auburn and Oklahoma. Had a really significant early move on Auburn in this one, where this number actually opened 6, and then it gradually came down to 3. It tipped below 3 here at the start of the new year. Got all the way down, actually, to Oklahoma -1 at Bookmaker and DSI. Now it's back up in the 2 range. Maybe we've got some people playing back and middling, or maybe we've got some public money here on Oklahoma. But how are you breaking this game down?
Yeah, well, you know, when you look at the opening number, obviously there are so many things going on, so many different games. If I had a second chance, I would have taken Auburn +6, and I don't just mean that as a line grab. I mean that I think Auburn +6 would have been a good play. You know, when I handicap this game now, I can't play anything now. I've lost way too much value to take Auburn +2. I didn't even want to take it at +3 there yesterday. You know, I think that there's been some respected people take Auburn here in this game in the last 24 hours, and that's why the line has dropped. And as far as the total, you know, this total is really tricky to me because I handicapped this total quite a bit. This number seems a little bit too high to me, but do I really trust the Oklahoma defense to do much of anything? You know, Oklahoma's given up a ton of points against just about everybody with a pulse on offense this year. You know, Ohio State's offense, which was really weak, we saw that throughout the course of the season, just torched this Oklahoma defense. And I'm not really sure this Oklahoma defense is much better now. Auburn doesn't have a great offense, but they're healthier on offense than they have been here in the past. Oklahoma, you know, their offense is going to be able to score a decent amount, I would assume. I don't like Baker Mayfield as much as some other people do. I think in some of these biggest games, he hasn't had his best performances. The Auburn defense is better than the defenses that Oklahoma has faced most of the year. It's just as far as the number, I think 67.5 that they're dealing right now is probably too high. I just can't get too excited to play the under. And I do like Auburn a little bit here. I'm not going to be surprised if they win straight up. But, you know, nothing enthusiastic for me on this one.
Well, and I think this brings up a whole different discussion, and this is something that we can, after we talk about the national championship, it'll be something that we segue into here. But you've got this situation where you've lost 4 points off the number, and the total's climbed 5 points, or 4.5 points. It opened 62.5 in a lot of places. So obviously you're not looking to play the side because you've already lost a significant amount of line value. Unless, of course, you like Oklahoma below the 3 and you want to make that play, then, you know, obviously you're getting – close to the best of it there in that respect. But in looking at a total here, you know, like I said, this one's moved up 4.5, 5 points, depending on what the opening number was at your favorite book. Does it concern you to go against that level of steam if you do like the under, or is it something where, you know, you're going to trust your number, you're going to trust what you think is a line value?
Yeah, I'm okay with going against the steam in a spot like that if I really like it. I do think the under is probably the right play just from a numbers standpoint right now. I wonder if this number might go even higher, though. It looks like a lot of the public taking the over. That's not really surprising. You know, the public likes to bet overs in these games. This is the night game, the only night game. So this number might go even a little bit higher, and then I imagine there will be some sharp money take the under here at some point. You know, I'm okay with going against this team if I like the game quite a bit. In this case, you know, I thought about it. Decided I didn't like it enough. If you look at just pace, you would like the under in this game because Oklahoma and Auburn, neither one are playing that fast. So 67.5, a lot of points in that situation. But I worry a little bit that the efficiency of these two offenses could be pretty good. Oklahoma's offense has been good against almost everybody. And like I said, Oklahoma's defense has made every other offense look really good. So I think it's the right play as far as the value. I just am not sure it's going to be the winner.
Well, and I think that, you know, again, that's something that we'll talk about here in a couple of minutes about going against that level of steam, you know, if you feel confident enough in a pick. And the reason we'll talk about it is because I wanted to discuss with Kyle here something I've sort of done with other, you know, guests and handicappers that we've had on the show here, sort of like a almost New Year's resolutions type of thing, because no matter how long you've done this, you're certainly not a know-it-all when it comes to to betting on sports. So we'll talk about that here in a couple of minutes. But I want to look at this opening line for the national championship game. And, of course, books kind of opened this thing sort of all over the place. Saw some sixes out there at Bookmaker. That immediately went to seven. Other places sort of settled on opening the number at Clemson plus seven with some extra juice. So we kind of see this number almost all over the place here with a week until game day. Where would you have set this number? Do you feel like it's in a pretty good range?
Yeah, this is a really tough one because I think the look-ahead number here was something like Clemson plus 11 or 12. And then obviously Clemson played so well in that game against Ohio State that they had to adjust it quite a bit. I know some of the books in Vegas had Alabama open as a 7.5 or 8-point favorite. That was really quickly bet down. I think 7 is the right number here. I think anything north of 7, all the sharp money is going to want to take Clemson in this spot. But if you deal under 7, there's going to be quite a bit of money on Alabama. So, you know, if I were opening the number, I would have opened it right at 7. I think that this is, you know, a very fair number on the side. You know, you like to take Clemson in a spot like this where they have chances at revenge. They have such a good defense. You know, obviously this Clemson defense didn't play as well as they did the other day all throughout the course of the season. Alabama's defense did play that well all year. I think Alabama's the better team, but Alabama does have some question marks. You know, freshman quarterback playing in a championship game against Deshaun Watson, obviously a big advantage for Clemson there. And, you know, just consider the fact that the SEC wasn't as good as it's been in some of the other years. I'm certainly not saying the SEC was a bad conference. It's just not as dominant as it has been in the past. I think Clemson north of 7, I want to take Clemson. At 7, I'm not sure what I'm going to do yet, to be totally honest with you. I haven't played anything on this game. Got to handicap this game some more. I feel like this is a very solid number right now.
Well, I think that there are a few different ways to look at it. For one thing, as you mentioned, you know, the look-ahead line was higher than this. It was approaching double digits or over double digits for a lot of people. And I really don't feel like the one-game sample size for both of these teams merits that big of a line adjustment. Because when you look at what happened in that game to Ohio State, I mean, they couldn't block Clemson. They didn't have the offensive line capable of doing it. We know that Alabama can. So right there, you're already neutralizing one of Clemson's biggest strengths in that game. Also, the big plays that Mike Williams had were when the Buckeyes got caught with their pants down and had somebody other than Marshawn Lattimore or Gerrion Conley on Mike Williams. So that's a mismatch that Jeremy Pruitt's not going to allow happen. Nick Saban sure as hell isn't going to allow it to happen. And I couldn't believe that Urban Meyer let it happen as many times as he did. And certainly that's something that Greg Schiano could have picked up on, you know, if Luke Fickell was the guy calling the shots there. I know they moved Mike Williams around. They put him in the slot a little bit. That's when they got the mismatch. Alabama can adjust to that. They can make the necessary moves that they need to in order to keep that from happening. The other point here about this game is that, you know, a lot of handicappers generally in terms of a power rating go from a scale of about 40 or 45 up to 100. And there were people that actually cracked their power ratings and had Alabama rated higher than 100. Throughout the season, because that's how good this team was. And, you know, from a body of work standpoint, I mean, Alabama's been phenomenal all season long. I think there's some credence to the point that you made about the SEC being down a little bit, but it almost feels to me, and don't get me wrong, it wouldn't surprise me if Clemson outright wins this game, but it feels to me like people have sort of forgotten about the body of work for both teams and are really only looking at what happened in the semifinals.
Yeah, I understand that point, certainly. I think that Clemson, you know, it's a spot where, like I say, I would kind of like to take Clemson if I could get more points. I'm not sure I'm going to now because the public perception of Clemson is so much higher because of that one-game sample size, like you say. The other thing I don't like doing is I don't like having a look-ahead line of plus 11 or 12 and then grabbing, you know, plus 6.5 or 7. Right after that, you feel like you've really not gotten a good value there. So this is going to be a hard side for me to take. I might be looking at the total instead. You know, as far as the total, I'll just go ahead and throw this out there. I think this total is really good right now, too. I'm not going to say exactly what I made this total, but it's very close to what the line is now. The sharp money big time on the under to start with here. I think that makes sense. The thing that concerns me a little bit about Now, if you want to play the under at 51.5, you know, obviously Clemson's defense was not this good throughout the course of the season. Like I said, you know, they looked really, really good against Ohio State, but Ohio State's offensive line is not good at all. And like you said, Alabama does have a good offensive line. You know, 51.5 is a fairly low number when you have two teams with solid offenses and a Clemson team that really plays fast. So I think both of these numbers are really sharp right now. To me, you know, this is a game I'm going to have to look at really in depth before I decide what I'm going to play, if I'm going to play anything. I know clients are going to want me to play something here. I'll probably play something small, but I don't think this is the spot where you're going to find any great value. You know, it is a national title game. You're not going to find anything under the radar.
I think that's a really good point you bring up about the total, and I knew that we were going to talk about it. I was going to try to intro it, but you took the words right out of my mouth there, because what's really interesting about this total sitting at 51.5 is what people are going to remember is that last year's game was 45-40, but that game had 40 points in the fourth quarter. That game became a complete and utter track meet in the fourth quarter. Now, to be fair, Alabama's much better at quarterback this year with Jalen Hurts over Jake Coker, but you know, that's what's really intriguing about the total here is that people are going to say, specifically public bettors, this is a game that had 85 points last year. Why is this total so low? But like you, I think this is an exceptionally sharp total. I think it's a great line from the odds makers. And I'll be very curious to see what happens with the movement because, as you said, the under a bit of a sharp side here, given that these are two really strong defenses, but you know public money is coming in on the over here. So I'm curious to see where this one actually closes.
Yeah, you know, I wonder how much more public or how much money there's going to be public on the over compared to normal. I think the public won't like the over quite as much as they would have before, obviously, because they saw the Clemson defense look amazing last weekend. They saw the Bama defense look really good once again. So we may see a little bit less public money than we normally would in a game like this. I will say right now, 63% of the bets so far have been on the under and 95% of the money. So big money on the under here. I think at 54, that makes sense. You know, 51.5, it's a close call. As far as the side, I wanted to say too, 64% of the bets so far on Clemson, 62% of the money on Clemson. So nothing earth shattering there in that one. Quite a few people looking to take Clemson money line here as the underdog. You know, I think that this is just a really good game. I'm really looking forward to it. Like you said, no doubt that these two teams are the teams that deserve to be here. As a fan, I'm looking forward to this game. As a handicapper, it's hard to find a lot of value in this game, but we'll see what we can find here in the next week.
Well, we'll talk about this game a little bit more on next Monday's show. Certainly looking at the line movement and then giving a little bit more of our concrete thoughts on whether or not a side or the total actually does have some line value here. But you would think, I mean, in theory, this should be the absolute sharpest line of the college football season, and it certainly looks that way as of now. But before we transition over to the college basketball side here for today's segment, as I mentioned already, you know, I'm sort of asking handicappers about some of the things that they've learned, maybe some of the things that they haven't taken into account enough here throughout the season, because no matter how long you've done this, you don't know it all. Nobody's flawless. There's no such thing as a stone cold lock. So I'm going to pose this question to you, Kyle. You know, as you've gone through the college football season here, is there something you've picked up on? Maybe something you feel you were too reliant on? You know, has something changed that maybe you were a little bit slow to adapt to? How do you sort of evaluate your 2016 college football performance?
Well, I mean, it's been a really good season for me. One of my best college football seasons. And I've put a lot of time into college football this year. Not that I haven't put a lot of time into it in the past, but an extreme amount of time this year. Certainly glad it's paid off well. I will say that one of the big things I've learned this year, when I'm doing totals, and everybody knows that totals are my specialty. It's something that I pick a lot more totals than I do sides. You know, one thing that you really need to look at more, something that I've looked at in the past, but I've kind of honed in on it more this year, efficiencies as far as offense versus looking just at tempo too much. You know, too many people look at tempo and see how a team's playing. I'll give a good example on this. The Pitt Panthers, you know, they were just an over machine this year. And every single week at the beginning of the year, for a long time, my numbers liked the under. And thankfully, I passed up on those plays because Pitt was just – they played so slow, but they had big plays on offense, and their secondary was so bad that teams would score back really quickly against them. So it's one of those spots where you have to be really careful to look at one thing too much. And this would fit for college basketball as well. You know, there's some teams that play really slow, but they shoot it well and they don't defend well. So that's one of the main things that I really kind of honed in on this year that's been better than I've done in the past. As far as the sides perspective, I would say something that I've done a little bit better here with this year and something that I'd like to continue to do in the future is to consider the situational spots, but not too much. You know, you have to use your power ratings number more than trying to look just at situational spots. I think sometimes in the past, what I've done is situationally handicap a little bit too much. You know, it still is a game between two teams that, you know, don't have exactly the same amount of talent. And if you have a talent edge and the line's fair, then I think you have to trust your numbers a little bit more than thinking that they could be in a bad spot. So that's something that I maybe did a little bit better this year than I have sometimes in the past. And I'd like to try to work forward on that as well. I think that, you know, it's always certainly good to look for spots, but you still have to trust your numbers. And you know, you don't want to take a spot if you think you have a big talent disadvantage and you're not getting that many points. You know, that's something pretty dangerous to do. So that's a couple of the things that I think I've worked on throughout the course of the season. I'm going to look forward to using those even more next year.
What about the flip side of that coin then? I mean, obviously we're talking about some things where you feel like maybe you came up a little bit short and something that you vow to change heading into next season. But what about things that you feel like you did better with this year that, you know, you'll continue to carry over to future seasons?
I think I did a good job this year with, you know, as far as volume of plays. A little bit less plays for me in college football this year than in the past. I still had plenty of plays, you know, on an average Saturday, 9 picks, 10 picks, something like that. Some of the years in the past I've done, you know, 15, 16 picks. I think that ended up just being a little bit too much for a lot of my clients. And, you know, what I tried to do is the plays that I don't like quite as much, the ones that would have been my lower rated plays, I just went ahead and passed on those plays. And it ended up working pretty well for me this year. The strongest plays are my plays that did the best this year. And my top-rated plays did extremely well this year, and that's something I'm really proud of. I know a lot of people, you know, bet a lot more money on the ones that you release as top-rated plays. And while I tell everyone that I don't really like the people who do the stepping out and betting two or three times what they do on other bets on the top-rated play, it worked for them this year. It's not always going to work for them. That's something that I have discussions with clients with pretty often. You know, I think that you know, when you have a year where you win as many top-rated plays as I did this year, I actually finished the year with 15 straight wins on top-rated totals. You know, it makes you look really good if you bet a ton of money on those top plays, but it's not always going to go that well for those. So that's just kind of a cautionary note for moving forward. But certainly that's probably the thing that I'm most proud of from this season is that those top-rated plays did so well.
You talk about limiting your volume a little bit, and I know that you've done that early in the college basketball season here because you were dedicating so much of your time to college football and, you know, still doing some feeling out of the college basketball side. Was that a conscientious decision with clients' bankrolls in mind, or is it more of a thing where the lines are getting sharper, so the edges are getting a little bit smaller, and therefore fewer plays are qualifying, you know, for your card?
Well, I think especially the totals market is getting sharper than it used to be. You know, I think just about any handicapper you would ask, both in college football and college basketball, a few years ago the totals market was a lot weaker than it is now. And I still think the totals market is certainly weaker than the sides market. But, you know, Vegas has gotten sharper on this. This is one of those where, you know, you can't just go out there and just be betting a ton of totals and find value in all of them. So that was a decision I made before the season with two things in mind. You know, one, that definitely I knew that the totals market was not as easy to beat as it had been in the past. And second of all, I think that it certainly does just help clients not to have you know, 15, 16 plays, because I know a lot of my clients would say, I can't play that many games. You got to, you know, just tell me which ones you like more, and I'll leave off some of the others. And that's a little bit difficult, because then what if they don't bet the games that win, and they do bet a bunch of the games that lose, and then they're sitting there afterwards saying, I wish I had a bigger bankroll. I would have been able to play everything. So I tried to limit that to help clients. And, yes, I mean, I think the edge is smaller than it used to be, so you have to try to hone in on the ones that you really like a lot and play a few more top-rated plays and have more of a distinction between the players as far as my rating on them.
Well, we'll certainly revisit this discussion here once we get into late July, early August, and we start previewing the college football season and look at, you know, season win totals and some of the look-ahead lines, games of the year lines, and all those types of things, because all that stuff will be coming out here. And, of course, that's another thing, I guess, to keep in mind, and maybe that's a good last point to finish on here, is Chris Andrews over at the South Point had a bunch of stuff out very, very early this year. I believe it was, what, late April or early May that some of this college football stuff started coming out over there with some week one lines, some games of the year lines, and also, you know, win totals, not just for Power Five, but also for Group of Five as well. So, you know, it's the timeline keeps getting accelerated year after year, and that's obviously something that people need to be aware of as well.
Yeah, it is. I think now's a good time to, you know, as much as it's hard to say this, it's a good time to start thinking about teams that you think could be on the rise for next season. You know, I'm sure that's something that we'll talk about probably even next week. But, you know, it's not too early to start thinking about teams that you're going to like to back next season based on what you saw to finish out this season or the coaching staff being there longer. You know, Washington's a team that we talked about at the end of last year that both of us thought would be really good. Washington was obviously much improved. They got into the Final Four there. So, you know, if you try to find a team where you're going to see a big upside compared to this year, you know, I think that could be a decent thing to start looking at already. I know it sounds very early, but like you said, you know, that timeline's it's coming a lot sooner than it used to. And I, honestly, I like that. You know, I like that people are putting those out earlier. It gives you more of a chance to look at things like season win totals, game of the year lines. I think that's always a good thing.
And I remember being really pissed off because we talked up Washington, and you and I weren't the only ones. I had Kyle Kensing of CFB Huddle that talked them up. Brad Powers talked them up as well. We were all over that Washington train. And then their win total came out, what, like 9.5 or something like that. And it was like, man, there's not going to be any value on this team left. And we only went 7-7 against the number, but they did wind up making their way into the college football playoffs. So anybody that took a shot on a Washington future had some ability to hedge it. It was kind of tough with, you know, Alabama being such a massive favorite in that game. But there were some opportunities to make money on this Washington team here throughout the year. So hopefully we can isolate a team like that heading into next year. And I can tell you right now, there's already a couple that I'm thinking of, maybe not from a national perspective, but certainly from a conference futures perspective or, you know, their respective divisions. So maybe we can hit on a few of those in next week's show. We'll transition over to the college basketball side here. And of course, as our Bang the Book radio listeners know, half points, full points, whether it's a side, whether it's a total, doesn't matter. All very, very important here in the college basketball market, as well as the NBA market, and then also those cents and dollars in the NHL moneyline market. So if you don't have an account over at DSI Sportsbook, probably something that you should do here. Go ahead and start that off with a new year. I know a lot of people are going to the gym and trying to get in shape and all that. Get your handicapping bankroll in shape and head on over to DSI. Use that BTB radio promo code. They'll get you a $10 free bet just for signing up and an additional 50 to 100% deposit bonus based on the amount of your initial deposit. The other option is the Bang200 promo code. They'll get you 100% bonus for the sportsbook, 100% bonus for the live casino on your initial deposit for both of those. So, Kyle, it's, you know, I think that this is going to be a pretty important college basketball segment for a lot of people here because college football is going to be done. There's only one more game left after today. NFL playoffs, there's only a limited number of those games left. So this is a discussion that we tend to have here at this time of the year. A lot of people starting to dabble now in college basketball. What suggestions, what advice would you have for them?
Yeah, definitely. Like we said last year, I think it's good that we've had this show now for quite a while here coming into where most people just kind of start looking at it this time of the year. We've been talking about it for quite a while. I have to say that, you know, I think most people that jump into it now, a lot of the public's going to want to lay the points with the favorites. And honestly, the favorites have done really well so far this year. It's something where especially road favorites have done really well. If you look at it, on the season, road favorites are 56.5%. Favorites in general, 51.75%. You know, I think that people like to lay the points with their favorite team or the big name team. And the cautionary note that I'm going to throw out to start this segment is, I think that that's not going to be a good play here the rest of the year. You know, the favorites have been covering too much. The odds makers know that they're going to get more money on the favorites, especially now when the public, you know, some of these people that they call public, and this is an interesting point too, obviously, public bettors aren't necessarily people who don't have a lot of money. So I think there's going to be more money coming in on the favorites than there has been in the past. And I think that that's going to create more value for the dogs. First point that I had here is just that I think that, you know, home underdogs are going to have a lot of value. You can't have home underdogs hitting 43.5% over the course of the season. I think those home underdogs are going to have more value because they're hitting at a low rate and because the public's going to drive up the number more. You know, you can get some pretty good teams in a home underdog role against another really good team. And it's a strong spot to play the home underdog. So I think that's something that you should really look at if you're just jumping in on the college basketball market. You know, another thing I would say is just, you know, if you're just jumping in right now, I would really strongly suggest you to not play a lot of games. I mean, you try to jump into this, bet a bunch of games all at once, I think you're going to have a lot of trouble. You know, if you haven't followed college basketball that much so far this season, start out slow. As we've said on a lot of these shows, I think it's something to always point out, though. Specialize in a certain conference, and you're going to do better than if you try to just be extremely broad.
I don't necessarily want to go off on a tangent, but, you know, we mentioned these really broad terms of sharp and public, and there are some very sharp segments of the betting public. They're just not betting big enough unit sizes to get the respect that they deserve out there in the marketplace. I mean, there are some people labeled public that are going to go out there and win 56, 57% in college basketball, but they're not betting dimes or five dimes or 10 dimes. They're not betting the amounts that are going to, you know, induce line moves or anything like that. So, you know, I think there's a really negative connotation when it comes to public bettors. And a lot of times the public bettors moving the lines are just people that kind of have FU money and they just play with it out there and make limit bets. And they're not going to be long-term winners, but they're just out there because they've made money doing something else, and they're going to spend it here, you know, invested in sports action. That's the public that largely moves lines. I mean, sometimes you get volume-based public moves if you've got a ton of, you know, $500 or $1,000 bets coming in from public players. But, you know, ultimately, there are some sharp segments out there of the public, and I like to think that a lot of those people are the ones listening to this show because, you know, like I've talked about in the past, I think one of the things that makes you sharp, even if you're not out there betting a dime or five dimes or whatever else, is the willingness to learn and the willingness to take advice and apply it to your handicapping, you know, from people that know more than you do about this industry. And there's nothing wrong with admitting that. And I think that's a good point to make here as we really do dig into college basketball because, you know, public players, the literal dictionary definition of the word, are going to be those people that Kyle was just talking about that are going to blindly bet Duke, blindly bet North Carolina and Louisville, blindly bet Villanova and Kansas. You know, but others are going to look for those opportunities, you know, to find those lines that don't make sense, even if it means fading those very public blue blood types of teams.
Yeah, and I like that point that you made there. I feel like, you know, there are quite a few people out there who are just laying a bunch of money just because they want to have action on a game. They've made a ton of money in something else. They don't really care if they make that much money when betting on a game. Honestly, they don't even really care if they lose a little bit of money. They just want to have action when they watch that game, go to a party and the game's on. They want to talk it up, but they laid a bunch of money on that game. There are quite a few people out there like that. I think that's where you can differentiate a lot of people who are just trying to bet a game and put a bunch of money on it versus somebody who's really trying to get better at sports betting, try to be more knowledgeable, like you said. And I have to assume that most people who are listening to this show are the people who really want to make money. And, you know, certainly that's what I hope. I think there's a lot of people out there who are looking to get more knowledge and find those extra edges. And I think that's what we try to do here on this segment.
All right. So now that I've completely derailed the segment here a little bit with my soapbox type of thing there about that, you know, we talked about conference specialization, and one of the things that we've been doing here over the last segments, I imagine you have some quick hitters points as well, so we will get to those. One of the things that we've been doing here throughout these segments is looking at some home court advantages in specific conferences. Is that something that you wanted to touch on here on today's segment as well?
Yeah, I wanted to talk about the Big 12 this week. You know, when you look at the Big 12, I talked about in the past that a lot of the big power conferences, the home court advantages aren't as big as they are in some of the small ones. I will say the Big 12, much bigger home court advantages here than in most power conferences. I wanted to point out three of them that I think are really notable. Oklahoma State's first. Oklahoma State, I think, deserves 6 or 6.5 points for home court, and I vary that based on the situation. This is just a tremendous place for the home team. These fans are raucous, and they're a lot closer to the floor than they are in most places. You can watch a game on TV that's at Gallagher-Eba Arena, and you can see why this would be a tremendous home court advantage. I think this is going to be a really good home court. It already has been a really good home court in the past, and I think it's going to be moving forward. As I've talked about, I really like the Brad Underwood hire, and I think Oklahoma State's going to be a really tough team to beat at home. I know West Virginia just beat them there. West Virginia is a very good team. I don't think they're going to lose very many games at home, though.
Nothing negates a home court advantage faster than a bad coach. And, I mean, there have been some there's obviously some very, very good coaches here in the Big 12, and, you know, it's obvious who those guys are. There have been some terrible coaches in the Big 12 over the last few years, some guys that we've beaten up week after week. Brad Underwood will not be one of them.
No, he won't. No, he's going to be one of the better coaches in the Big 12. Like you say, there are some very good coaches in the Big 12. There have been some weak links here in the past. Some of those guys are gone now. I'd say the weakest of those guys are gone now. The Big 12, I think it's a basketball conference, is going to be getting better. And Oklahoma State, the best home court advantage here in this conference. Second one for me is Iowa State. Listen, I mean, you know all about the Hilton magic. You know, Hilton Coliseum, there are all kinds of crazy things that go on here. Iowa State routinely makes these huge comebacks in the second half, just like they did last game against Texas Tech there at home. They were down pretty bad in the second half. I think 14 points there, came back and won that game. Iowa State, I give them 5.5 points for home court advantage. Iowa State is going to routinely just be that much better at home than they are on the road. I think Iowa State's a team that has some weaknesses and some flaws this year. On the road, I wouldn't like to back them very much. At home, I think that there's going to be some good spots to back them. You know, Hilton Coliseum, it's just a tremendous place to play.
Yeah, and let's talk for a second here, you know, about what you're using to quantify home court advantage. I mean, this is a place, Ames is not particularly easy to get to. You know, if you're flying, you got to fly into Des Moines and then go, what, about a half hour north or so, kind of out there on its own a little bit, especially relative to the rest of the teams here in the Big 12. So travel is part of it, but what else are you looking at here in terms of quantifying a home court advantage?
Yeah, these are back-tested numbers. I've got some data that I work with based on how a team's done in the past on the road versus at home. So you just kind of look at the differentiation of how they've done one place versus another. And then I also put some, you know, subject or objectivity to it. You know, you try to look at, you know, like you said, travel and different situations for it. So some of this is based on data from the past. Some of it also is just me putting in what I think, you know, should be fair based on the fact that there's different travel spots too there, based on the fact that, you know, teams have a rough time getting up for games there, or teams do get up for games there. That's one of the points that you would also want to point out too, that in some of these big conferences, you know, some of the places like, say, Duke, Cameron Indoor, obviously people are really pumped to play there. You're not going to get teams go in there flat, so that helps the road team some, even though it's a really tough place to play. Some of the other places, I don't think that, you know, the Big 12, this is one where I would say that, but there are conferences where teams go into that place not very excited to play, and then you've got a home team that's really not that good of a team, but they're really jacked up for that game. The other team is not. So that's something you have to consider. There's a lot of things that go into it. You know, I do have a lot of data from the past that I have used to get to these home court advantage numbers. I think that you got to go on several years of data for this. You certainly can't look at just one season. You know, any of these teams could have one bad year at home, but I think the more data you get, the better.
Well, and another thing, of course, shooting backdrops is something that we talk about, and you know, there are varying ones, particularly in the smaller conferences, where some people play in small things that are, you know, basically glorified high school gyms. Others play in, you know, like civic center type arenas where it's a 10,000 seat barn and there's 800 to 1200 people in it. So, you know, that's obviously something that factors in here as well. So what's the other one in the Big 12 the other one in the Big 12 where you feel like there's a pretty good home court advantage?
Yeah, Kansas State's the other one, and I think this one's the most underrated home court advantage. You know, Manhattan, Kansas, it's a little bit out there too, and I think Kansas State, you know, their fans get into the games quite a bit, and I think that this could be the one where people go to Kansas State not really excited to play there, have a little bit of a flat spot. Kansas State doesn't have as much talent as some of the teams in this conference, but they're going to give some good teams a hard time here. I think that Kansas State is one of those teams, again, where I'm not going to be looking to back them on the road. I don't think Kansas State's really that good of a team this year, and they've played a really weak schedule so far this year, so that's part of the reason they have such a good record. But at home, I think there could be some good spots to back them. The one other one that I would say that's a little bit of a wild card right now is TCU. TCU getting a new place, you know, it's kind of hard to quantify what that means for them, and obviously TCU is a better team than they've been in the past. I would say TCU had one of the worst home court advantages in the past. Right now, it's hard for me to know exactly how the new place is going to be. You know, it's not that big of a place, and I think they're going to fill it up pretty consistently. You know, I think the program's on the rise. So I think that that's one that's a number that will probably be higher. In the past, I've given TCU 3 points for home court advantage. I imagine that that's too low right now.
And I just want to tell our listeners here that, you know, I think the advantages of this segment, I think that at a minimum, it's twofold, because you're learning what's a really good home court advantage. And at the same time, you know, people may look down if, say, West Virginia goes to Kansas State and loses, and they'll be like, well, how could they lose to Kansas State? You know, they're a better team than Kansas State. Sure, they are. But Kansas State has a legit home court advantage. A lot of times you're going to run into these situational spots where maybe West Virginia just played Kansas and then they have to go to Kansas State. Winds up being a much tougher game than they bargained for. So I think that, you know, you need to learn how to properly value both wins and losses, because if you go on the road and you're in a tough environment against an inferior team and you win that game convincingly, a lot of people just kind of scoff at that and say, well, you know, West Virginia is a lot better than Kansas State. Sure, they are. But they went on the road to Manhattan in maybe what was a tough situation, something like that. That's a win that deserves respect. On the flip side, you know, if you're a bad team and you wind up scalping a big win over a conference power or something like that, you know, people may consider it a fluke, but maybe that is a microcosm of what that home court advantage is like, because, you know, hey, there are good losses and there are bad wins out there in college basketball. I think you just need to put all of it in the proper perspective.
Yeah, I think so too, and I think a really good point you made there is that you find a lot of these teams that get in spots where they play back-to-back games, say, at Kansas and at Kansas State, or at Oklahoma State and at Kansas State, something like that, and they're going to be playing in that spot. They're playing a really good team. Say they win that game in a really tough, hard-fought game, and they're coming off this just huge victory. It's easy for the public to say, oh, man, you know, now they just have to go to Kansas State. Man, Kansas State, they're not very good. I'm just going to go ahead and lay the points there. That's a really dangerous spot to back a team that's just won a big game. And on the flip side, if they put a lot into the game and they come up just short, it's certainly a flat spot for that next game. So I think that these home court advantage things are something that bettors can use to their advantage in multiple situational spots like that. And it's good to know which ones have the really good home court advantages, because if you can catch a team who could be in a bad spot laying too many points against one of these teams, it could be a really good spot to find some value.
So are there some Big 12 advantages that you don't think much of at home?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Texas is not as good as some of the others. I know that they have a big place and they can fill it up pretty well, but consistently over the years, Texas hasn't been as big of a home court advantage based on the data as some of the others. You know, in general, like I said, the Big 12 really has a lot of good home court advantages, and everybody knows that Kansas is a really tough place to play. In the past, Baylor hasn't been quite as good of an advantage. But Baylor has been really, really good this year. I think the fans are more invested in the program than they've been. I would say Texas Tech is probably the second one that was the worst home court advantage. I give them 3.5 points right now. And one thing you have to remember, like I said, you know, the average home court advantage is somewhere between 3.5 and 4 points. I usually make it about 3.5 at home as the average. So you're talking the Big 12 having almost no one with really an under – less than normal home court advantage. So this is a conference in general that has a lot of good home court advantages.
I think Chris Beard's going to do some work down there in Lubbock, though. They're 11-2 this year. They haven't played a great schedule, but you know they had a shot to win in Ames. They take on West Virginia at home this week, and then they go to Kansas here on the weekend. So pretty good litmus right away in conference play for Chris Beard's Red Raiders. I'm sure you've got some quick hitters points to mention here for this segment, so let's cover those, and we got a couple of games to hit on.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about injuries. Princeton, you know, the Ivy League's going to have a lot of games on Friday coming up. You know, I've been honest in the past. For some reason, the Ivy League is just one that I cannot win at very often. So I always try to take it easy in the Ivy League. Try not to be a hero on those Friday night games when the Ivy League is kind of has the standalone night. I think the Ivy League, there's just some strange things that happen in those games, and I don't really know exactly why, but it certainly is the case. I'll say, though, that Princeton, Henry Caruso and Hans Braves both out for the year. Princeton had a really high upside. This was a team that some people had picked to win the Ivy League. I don't think they're the favorite in the Ivy League anymore, and I think their upside is at least somewhat limited.
And you got to keep in mind, too, that when some of these smaller teams lose key players, it really becomes a problem because, unlike the power conferences, there's not a lot of depth on some of these teams. I mean, consider Yale, for example. I mean, without Mekhi Mason, this is a team that people were looking at to go to the NCAA tournament, possibly knock off a couple of teams. But now Yale, just 6-5 in the non-conference, and we'll see what they do here, you know, as conference play goes on.
Yeah, I think Yale's still going to do well in the Ivy League. But, again, their upside's limited based on what it could have been in the past. And the next one on my list, St. Joe's, Shavar Newkirk is out for the year. He got hurt in their last game against George Washington. Now, he was the team's best player, and St. Joe's lost a lot from last year. This is a team that was already way, way down. I'm going to look to fade St. Joe's in the coming weeks if the price is right. I'm really looking forward to seeing what the books do to adjust to this because I think St. Joe's is a really a team that's not got much depth at all this year for a big-name team, or at least a somewhat big-name team. You know, St. Joe's has had some good teams here in the past. I think Phil Martelli's a good coach, definitely. But I think he has his work cut out for him now.
And the A-10 is always one of those really – I think it's a tough conference to handicap because there are a lot of teams that are pretty good, a couple that generally tend to be really good. But that's a conference where you've got some really underrated home court advantages. I imagine we'll touch on that. I know that there's one that you really like there in the A-10 that you've played on before. But that's for my money, I think in terms of the mid-majors, that's one of the most challenging conferences to figure out.
Yeah, and there are some really good home court advantages in the A-10. Actually, I'm going to make a note. I think that'd be a good one to talk about next week. The next point I wanted to make is actually a player who's coming back, South Carolina's Sendarius Thornwell. He's returning from a suspension on Wednesday. Thornwell's really been missed a lot by this team. He is definitely their best all-around player. He kind of gets the offense going, and he's definitely their best defender as well. South Carolina struggled a little bit without him. I think South Carolina's going to immediately get a shot in the arm from him coming back, and I think that South Carolina, some people could be seeing them as one of those teams that they're going to fall off. You know, they had that fast start. In the past, they've had some of these fast starts, and then they kind of fall apart. I don't think that's going to happen this year, and I think the only reason they've been weaker here of late is just because Thornwell was gone.
I think we talked about Thornwell when that suspension was announced, and you said it was probably a 2.5, 3-point adjustment in your power rating for South Carolina, and you can correct me if I'm wrong. after seeing how they played with him out, did you adjust that number and say, you know what, maybe he's more of a 3.5 or a 4-point guy?
Yeah, I think he is more of a 3.5 or 4-point guy. It's always hard to quantify exactly how much a guy means to a team until he's not really there. So that's something you have to adjust. You see what, you know, how the team's done. You can also gain something from watching a game without a guy like that. You know, I watched South Carolina and Clemson, obviously that being a good rivalry game. South Carolina a lot less sure of themselves without Thornwell on the floor. So, yeah, he's very, very important to them.
All right, any other points for the quick hitters, or are we going to the two games here?
I wanted to just throw out real quickly some disappointing teams. You know, Washington, I have to wonder how long is Lorenzo Romar going to be there? At this point, you know, they're 7-6 on the year. Their best win at home is against Long Beach State. Markelle Fultz, he's tremendous, but Washington still can't win games for some reason. I think they've been a really big disappointment. A couple others, Syracuse, 8-6 on the year, certainly higher expectations here. I think that, you know, this Syracuse team is one that the transfers aren't really fitting in as well as some people thought they would. I think Boeheim is a really good coach, obviously, so they'll probably improve throughout the course of the season, but you got to be careful betting Syracuse right now. And then one under-the-radar one, UTEP. You know, I don't know what on earth is wrong with the Miners, but this team has way, way too much talent to be getting beat by teams like Northern Arizona, Maryland, Eastern Shore, and UTSA. I just have to say, you know, do not bet on UTEP right now. This team is totally unbackable. Wait and see what happens. You know, we got to see them bottom out before you try to catch a falling knife. So, you know, I have to wonder what's going on there at UTEP, and really I have no idea.
Well, we'll hit on a couple of games here to wrap up this first segment with Kyle of 2017. Beginning with Iowa State and Baylor. We just talked about the Big 12, talked about some of those home court advantages. Baylor, not one of the stronger ones, but as you said, you know, people starting to really come around on this program. I don't know if maybe it has something to do with all the extenuating circumstances that went on with the football team. And, of course, I'm, you know, trying to downplay the wording there of that as much as I possibly can, because it was obviously a horrible situation down there in Waco. But on the college basketball side here, you got Baylor on Wednesday night with Iowa State in town. You mentioned Iowa State nearly losing that game to Texas Tech. Why do you want to talk about this one?
Well, first of all, I wanted to give Baylor some credit and Scott Drew some credit. You know, he's a guy that we've bashed a little bit in the past, and we've really done a good job with the guys that we pick on here in the past, both in college basketball and college football. But this is probably one where we were too hard on him. Scott Drew has had some teams that have really rounded into form late in March, and they play their best basketball, and that's a sign of a good coach. And at this point, Baylor is really playing some excellent basketball. They're a really well-balanced team. The thing I wanted to point out here is that I think Baylor has a big advantage over Iowa State in the front court. You know, Iowa State has a really, really good backcourt. Monty Morris, he's a really good point guard. He's one of the best point guards in the country, no doubt. Not a huge scorer, more of a guy who's going to distribute and be very good at that. You know, Morris is obviously going to score a decent amount of points, but, you know, he's not a scorer first. Baylor, you know, they have a really good front court. Offensive rebounds are really big for them. They get 36% of their misses back. You know, Iowa State, they had a really good front court in the past with Niang. They don't really have that good of a front court now. I really think that this is a bad matchup for Iowa State. The problem is you're obviously going to have to lay a lot of points to bet Baylor in this game. So I'm not necessarily saying I want to bet Baylor here, but I'd be careful betting Iowa State against Baylor. And even in the past, really, Iowa State hasn't played very well against Baylor. I think Baylor's won a couple times there at Ames when nobody else can win there. So this seems to be a matchup that favors Baylor.
Well, that's what you want to look for. You want to look for those matchups where teams have really powerful front courts, at least relative to the rest of the conference. And yeah, I think of Purdue being another one in the Big Ten where their front court is just tremendous. I mean, it's an elite front court, and they've already, you know, shown their dominance with that in that game where they just totally blew away Iowa. One more game that you wanted to touch on here, we'll go out west to the West Coast Conference. This is one that we talked about a little bit in some previous segments, because this is a conference on the rise with some good new head coaches out there. But the game that you want to focus on is Thursday night's tip between Loyola Marymount and Pepperdine.
Yeah, and this is the one that's kind of a premium look ahead for me. I think I'm going to be on Loyola Marymount in this game. I actually had Marymount on Saturday against BYU. They got the money, but, man, it was close. You know, they blew that game in epic fashion. They were leading the whole game, give up an 11-0 run to finish the game, lose by five. I had them at +7, so that was a close one. I think Marymount, though, is quite a bit better than some people think. This is a team who gave St. Mary's some trouble at home, and then BYU, they should have beaten. Now they go to Pepperdine. Pepperdine is way, way down this year. They're playing without Udini, one of their key players in the backcourt. And I think that Pepperdine, you know, you look at their schedule, what they've done here lately, this is one of the reasons why I want to back Loyola Marymount too. Pepperdine's coming off a 6-game road trip. They've played a ton of games on the road. They're shorthanded to start with. They don't play that many guys on the bench, not a deep bench. This is a Pepperdine team that's really weak on defense, and I think Loyola Marymount's just a much better rounded team. I think they're just a much better team than is Pepperdine. You know, Pepperdine has a decent home court advantage there, but it's certainly not the best in the West Coast Conference. I think Marymount, a much deeper team, have some really good young talent, some guys that are getting much, much better. Trevor Manuel really stepping up as a 6'9 sophomore for them. And they have Stefan Jovanovic, who transferred over from, I believe it was Hawaii. And so this is, you know, a Marymount team that is certainly much better than it's been in the past. I think they have a good coach there in Mike Dunlap. I think you're going to get a pretty decent number on this one. Probably helps the value for this that Marymount just lost its last game against BYU. Marymount should be favored in this game, but I think he'll be laying a small amount of points, and I like Marymount in this game.
Yeah, Trevor Manuel's an Oregon transfer, too. So, I mean, they've got some talent there on that roster. So you are thinking Marymount's a slight favorite, maybe a bucket and a half, something like that?
Yeah, I think they're probably 2.5, 3-point favorite, and I think that's fair.
All right. Well, we'll see how that line plays out. That game, of course, coming up here on Thursday night, and that is, you know, if it's in range, that would be an exclusive free pick for our show listeners from Kyle Hunter. But Kyle Hunter of huntersportspicks.com, what is going on over there at the website, man?
Yeah, also point out that I had a couple listeners do that last week. Feel free to reach out to me when I give you one of these exclusive premium picks. You can email me or email me, Kyle at huntersportsfix.com, or just send me a message on Twitter, and I'll let you know whether that actually is going to be a play based on where the number came out, because there are some times where you just have to pass on a game just because of price. Obviously, it has to be price-dependent, so I give you these look-aheads, but depending on what happens when the line comes out, it might change. You know, go to huntersportsfix.com, sign up for that free picks newsletter. 41 and 21 in my last 62 free picks sent out to the newsletter subscribers. So definitely sign up for that. And I also just wanted to say thank you to all the listeners and people who have become clients by listening to this show this year. You know, I didn't really say this last week. I know Adam had some nice words there at the end of 2016. I have to say that I think 2016 was a really good year for this Bang the Book radio show in general. And I certainly am appreciative of being a part of it. And just wanted to thank all the listeners for tuning in and also for, you know, for the support over the years.
Make sure you follow Kyle on Twitter at Kyle Hunter Picks. Kyle Hunter, huntersportspicks.com. Appreciate your time as always, man. Thank you so much. I'll talk to you again next week.
Sounds good. Thanks.
There you go. There is our first show of 2017. Coming up on our Tuesday show, we'll have Brian Leonard for our sports wagering talk. In his words, assuming he's not hungover because he's going to the Rose Bowl here today, won't have Sports Cheat on the show until next week. He's still doing some holiday travel and all those types of things, but we will find a guest for the second part of tomorrow's show. And things, we're going to have to kind of play them by ear a little bit here. As we transition over mostly into basketball, our deal with Cole Ryan ran out at the end of 2016. That was not renewed, so we won't have our Gridiron Gambling Report segment with him. We'll see if we decide to do something for the NFL regular season in 2017. But we'll be bringing you some different guests, some different basketball minds, both NBA and college basketball. We'll still have Brad Powers of BradPowersSports.com and also Ralph Michaels of WagerTalk.com on Thursdays. But we've got some different segments to fill here, most notably on Wednesdays and Fridays. We'll have Wes Reynolds on Wednesday this week. We also have a golf event to talk about this week with Wes, the SMS Tournament of Champions out there in Kapalua, Hawaii. certainly would love to be at that this week. We'll get some thoughts with him on that tournament on Wednesday's show, but we'll just kind of play it by ear. We'll have some different people joining the broadcast here. We'll get some different voices to help us out with college basketball and the NBA, and we'll see if we can get some NHL stuff in here a little bit more frequently as well. Well, that'll do it for today. Thank you so much for listening, everybody, and I will talk to you again tomorrow.